To start off this hour, let me introduce you to William Poundstone, who has written a new book called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. It is all about how companies figure out what is the right price to charge you for whatever they're trying to sell you. What price can they get that will maximize sales, maximize profits for them? William, welcome to 84WHAS.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Nice to have you on here. Before we get to anything in your book, how did your company decide that your book was worth $26.99?
Well, actually, they started at $27, but they figured since I'm writing about those 99-cent prices that they ought to use one, so they did.
And I'm looking at your Amazon page right now, and they're selling it for $17.81. That's a weird number.
Yeah, Amazon always discounts, and for some reason they don't use those nine-ending prices.
All right, let's talk about the nine-ending prices. We see it in pretty much everything that we buy, particularly gas prices, $2.53.9, $2.61.9. Mm-hmm. Does that make more money for them? Are we really thinking psychologically as Americans that it's only $2.61 when it's really $2.61.9?
Yeah, everyone thinks they're not influenced by that, but they actually are. The interesting thing, they've done experiments where a catalog company will print up two different versions of their catalog, and they'll have the same item in both catalogs, but in one, it'll be selling for $35, and in the other, it'll be selling for $39. And more people buy it at $39.
Huh.
Apparently, there's just something in our mind that tells us if it ends in nine, it must be discounted. It must be a good deal.
Like, originally, might have been $40, but I'm getting it for $39, so I'm getting the deal.
Yeah, which isn't even that big a discount, but people are so attuned to that it really does work.
All right, I want to ask you about one specific product, the iPhone. Mm-hmm. I have an iPhone. I've had one for a couple of years. I didn't buy it when it first came out because it was like $600.
Mm-hmm.
Then a year or so later, Apple lowered the price to $400. That's when I got in. Now you can get one for a couple hundred dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Same phone. I mean, they've changed the technology, of course, and it's probably cheaper for them to make it now.
Mm-hmm.
But did they have trouble finding the right price point when they first introduced this product? And do other companies run through the same problem?
No, they use price consultants, which are the experts who are, you know, very good at the psychology of prices. And that was very intentional what they did. They came out with a very high price, knowing that there would be all these Apple fanboys who would be buying it at that $600 price. And then when the sales started to tail off, that's when they dropped it to $400, outraging a lot of the people who bought it at full price. But that's called price segmentation, where they have different prices for different people based on how much they're willing to pay. And it's certainly one of the basic principles that they try to use.
There are price consultants?
Yeah, this is really the thing that really surprised me in this book. I talk about how psychologists started studying the psychology of price back in the 70s, and then suddenly a group of business experts decided, hey, we can use this stuff to help companies make money. So there's now this profession called price consultant, and all they do is tell companies how to use psychology to find the most effective price. The largest of these consultants is known as Simon Kucher and Partners, and I write about them in the book. They're based in Germany, actually, but if you look at their list of clients, it reads like the Fortune 500. They advise Coke, Pepsi, Microsoft, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, basically all those cell phone companies, the big airlines. Whether you're selling airline tickets or toilet paper, the same psychology applies.
Eventually, you got to get into the consumer's mind and convince them this is the right price for this product, because consumers have no idea how much something costs, do we?
Yeah, one of the major findings of the psychology is that people really don't have this innate sense of value. So you're very open to suggestion about what a good price is, particularly if it's something where it's very hard to compare. A good example is flat screen TVs, because they're so complicated now, they're very technological, that you really can't compare them feature by feature. You don't know how long they're going to last. So you tend to infer value from the price. And what they've found is that if you have two TVs there, one is marked $800 and one is $1,000 discounted to $800, practically everyone is going to get the discounted one.
Wow.
Even though they have no reason to believe it's any better. They just assume that if it was supposedly originally at $1,000, it's got to be a better set. And everyone likes the idea that they can tell their friends, oh, I got a $200 discount. So they know that, and that's why they give you these discounts, which in most cases are kind of bogus.
You know, I got to admit to being guilty of that myself. We first got HD TV in my house just a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. I bought a big one for the living room and a smaller one for the bedroom. And the one in the bedroom I bought specifically because the price tag said discounted $100.
Yeah, that's known as a reference price. And I spoke with one of the guys who was involved with that, a consultant called Donald Lichtenstein. And he said he was looking at tennis rackets. And even though he invented practically this whole idea, even he was still influenced by those discounts.
Does the same thing also apply where people look at something that costs more and say, okay, well, that must be better? I mean, even if it's not discounted, you talk about the $800 TV versus the $1,000 TV. Are there people who look at it and go, well, that $1,000 TV must be a better TV, when in fact it may not be?
Absolutely. And again, as so many products are technological now and very hard to understand, the price really is all the more important in conveying a sense of value. Another good example is high fashion. You know, why are some shoes worth more than others? It really comes down to the reputation that that the seller has, and that's based largely on price.
I want to go back to Apple for a second because I think that they are such a brilliantly run company. Steve Jobs and his people really, you know, software, hardware, design, and also this pricing point, which we're talking about here. It really came into play with the iPhone apps, so many of which are free, and even more of them are just 99 cents.
Uh-huh.
People are getting rich off of 99 cent items, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, 99 cents really is this magical price. Almost everyone is very susceptible to that. They feel that it must be a good deal if it's 99 cents. So even some of those apps are pretty minor things, but people will gladly pay that price.
And I've also heard that some of these companies who designed these apps went to Apple and said, yeah, we'd like to sell these for $10, $9.99. And they tried it, and they only sold a few thousand, and then Apple said, you know what? Lower the price to 99 cents and you'll make more money. It sounds counterintuitive, but boom, now they got a million people buying their product.
Yeah, exactly. But I can even give you another example. The 99 cent store, which is a big chain of discounters, that actually got its start when this guy named David Gold, who was running a liquor store, had all this wine that wasn't selling. So he decided to put this cheap wine on sale. He just made a big sign saying, wines of the world, 99 cents each. And he had things that had been priced at 79 cents, but once they were priced at 99 cents, everyone started buying it. So it worked so well that he joked to friends, you know, this 99 cents is such a great price, I should open a store that sells only things for 99 cents. And eventually, you know, the joke became reality, and it's now a very successful chain.
Now, I'm curious, does the 99 cent store do better than the dollar store?
Yes, it's, you know, pretty much the same products, but that 99 cents, it seems like you're getting a discount, and the dollar, not so much.
In fact, you write in the book that the 99 cents only store has a better profit margin than Walmart.
Yeah, Walmart is synonymous with discounting, but their gross profit margin is about 20%, whereas the 99 cent store, it's about 40%. So there's a really big difference there. What that means is that they're paying about 30 or 40 cents for the things that they're selling you for 99 cents. And of course, everyone who buys them thinks they're getting such a great deal.
William Poundstone's book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. We'll come back with more in a moment as the Francine Show continues with Paul Harris on 84 WHAS. 45 degrees now in Louisville. Paul Harris filling in for Francine and talking with William Poundstone, whose book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. Let's get to the second part of your title there. How can consumers take advantage of how companies price things, not just with the nine at the end and making sure that you have an eye on what's discounted and what's really worth the right, what really has the value of it, but how can I, when I'm shopping for anything, take advantage of these pricing games?
Well, certainly it's helpful to be aware of these things. I find just going to the supermarket is a whole different experience because you see all these very the tricks that I've written about in the book, and it is helpful to be a little more immune to them that way. But I think one of the ways you can take advantage of it is anytime you're negotiating, like for a salary or buying a house, selling a car or something like that. I described studies with that in the book, and one of the things they found is that the first number in a negotiation really has a big statistical effect on the final negotiated price. Now, in a salary negotiation, a lot of people figure, I'm going to let the employer name a price first, because they figure, first of all, I don't really know what I'm worth in today's job market, so if I ask for too much, I'm going to get ridiculous, I'll look ridiculous, and if I ask for too little, well, obviously I'm cheating myself. But that turns out to be a costly mistake, because it turns out that if you do ask for a high number, at least on the high end of reasonable, you're going to end up with more money. You won't get what you first asked for, obviously, but you will end up with more. So that's certainly one of the things that these price consultants tell people when they're advising on any sort of negotiated price situation.
You know, it's so funny you should mention this, because very early on in my radio career, I got a job offer someplace, and I went in there, and they said, you know, how much are you looking for? And I said, well, I can't do it for less than this.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you know what, I don't think we can do that. And they gave me a number that was lower than that, and I stood fast. No, it's got to be this number.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, I ended up working for the same guy at another radio station in a completely different city, and he said, remember when we negotiated back then? And I said to him even later, I said, I was proud of myself because I stood firm on what I had to be paid then. He said, you were way low. We would have paid you a lot more. But you insisted that was going to be your salary. So I learned then that when they say, how much do you want? You say, well, how much will you pay me? And, you know, put the ball in their court. Let them be the ones who speak first, because I think you're absolutely right. Whoever speaks first is the one who's going to be responsible for that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that does make it a little easier nowadays, I mean, there are all these websites like salary.com where you can punch in your zip code, your years of experience, and the type of job. And they'll give you actually a bell-shaped curve of what the salaries are in your area. And you can go to the 90 percentile range, like the point at which 90% of the people in your business make less than this amount. That 90 percentile number is a good one to start with in your negotiation. Mm-hmm. It won't look ridiculous, and while you probably won't get that amount, it will have this anchoring effect and tend to get you more than you would otherwise.
Now, does the same thing apply to things like, off the top of my head, real estate, which of course is in a horrible market right now, and people aren't getting anything near fair value for their homes? But again, that's a negotiation, right?
Yeah, I write about this incredible experiment in the book that was done in Tucson, where they took a bunch of working real estate agents to see a number of houses that were actually on the market, and they had them tour the houses just like they normally would. They gave them printouts of comps and a description of the house. And then they asked these agents, in your estimate, what is a fair market value for this house? Now, there were actually several groups of real estate agents, and the only variable was that each group saw a different listing price for the house. And what they found was that those listing prices made a huge difference in the real estate's estimates of the market value. Now, of course, the agents would be the first one to say, look, the listing price is irrelevant. It's the market that sets the price. But even for these professionals, they were influenced by that listing price. And the higher the listing price, the higher their estimate of what that house was worth. So as it happened, one of the psychologists doing this study, her mother was a real estate agent. And she was terribly upset about this. It actually took several years for her to accept that this was actually true. But it definitely is, even for something with where you're talking real money and where there's a definite market value, you can still be influenced by the first number you hear.
I got to take a break. We'll come back and talk more with William Poundstone. His book is Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. This is the Francine Show with Paul Harris on 84 WHAS. Francine's still off. I'm Paul Harris. Proud to be filling in. Thanks for listening. Having an interesting conversation here today with William Poundstone, the author of the book Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. List price $26.99. On Amazon, it's $17.81. I just love that since we're talking about prices. I got to throw that in a couple of times. William, let's talk a little bit about food, which takes up so much of the average American's budget. And you mentioned in the last segment, walking through the supermarket, and you write about this extensively in the book, about how supermarkets set themselves up, not just when it comes to price, but about the way they put their products on the shelves and where they put them to get our attention.
Yeah, one of the interesting things they found is that someone who goes to a supermarket counterclockwise spends about $2 more per visit than someone who goes to clockwise. So just in the past few years, markets have really done everything they can to make sure that people go through their stores counterclockwise. Usually they have two entrances, right and left, and they try to funnel people into the right entrance so that you'll be on track to go through the way they want you to. They're not quite sure why this works, but they think it's because we regard our shopping carts as cars and try to go on the right side of the aisle. And of course, since most people are right-handed, that makes it so much easier to take stuff off the shelves and toss it in the cart.
Wow. That's amazing, and I'm now thinking of the places that we usually go food shopping, and you're exactly right. Even if you enter from the left, all the shopping carts are over on the right side. They want to funnel you that way, get you through the deli section, the produce section, and they always want you to work around last to where the dairy section is, because even if you're just going in for milk, they want you walking through the rest of the store and thinking, oh, you know what, I like that, I'm going to buy that on the way.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing they do is close off the left entrance early, so you get in the habit of going to the right one because you know that'll be open.
Very, very clever. Now, what about the companies that are making the food that's going on the shelves? In recent years, it seems to me like they have changed packaging, even sometimes not changing what's inside the package, but packaging itself is changing to get us to spend more.
Yeah, that's one of the big things that price consultants do. For one thing, they've found that you always want the package to look as big as possible because you think you're getting more for your money. So they have various ingenious ways of doing that. But ironically, at the same time, they're always concerned about giving you less for your money because just because of inflation, they always have to raise prices. So what they actually do, since they don't want to actually raise the price you see posted, because then you might switch brands, instead they make the package so that it has less content. But they have to do that invisibly. One of the things that they recommend, and they had Kellogg do actually, was to make its cereal boxes thinner. Now, they're still as wide and tall on the shelf, but the box itself is thinner and has less cereal. Skippy's peanut butter put a dent in the bottom of its plastic jar. And this takes about an ounce and a half of peanut butter out of there, but it let them keep the same price for less peanut butter.
But it looks the same to the consumer.
Yes, exactly. Best example of that, Puffs Tissues recently shrank their tissues by about, I think it was a fifth of an inch, which is small, but it adds up. And of course, no one would ever realize that because the hole is in the middle of the tissue box, so you're never going to know that there's like about a half an inch of airspace on either side.
Wow, I love all this stuff.
Yeah.
Now, you're the perfect person to ask about something I've wondered about since I was a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time ago. When I was a kid, on one of my parents' anniversaries, we went out to a fancy restaurant. I don't know that it was really that fancy, but for a kid, any place that wasn't, you know, McDonald's or Roy Rogers or one of those places was considered fancy. Anyway, it was a sit-down restaurant, and when they brought the menus, my dad's menu had prices on it. My mom's menu and mine and my brother's didn't. Now, I don't know if restaurants are still doing that today, but that must have been either the psychology or the sexism of the era.
Yeah, well, it's certainly both, but it was good psychology in the sense that the woman and children are not going to be inhibited by the price, and they'll buy whatever they want, which, of course, is often the most expensive, most profitable things. So it's a great example of that. But I can give you a sort of a modern-day counterpart of that with text messages. It's the kids who are sending the text messages and the parents who are paying the bills. So So these are one of the most profitable things in American business today. In the book, I looked at what a text message really should sell for based on the cost of bandwidth from a cell phone. And if you factor it out, it should really cost you about 1/1,000th of a penny. But instead, the average price paid per text message actually comes out to about 20 cents now. And again, it's because the people who are paying for it are not the people actually using it.
And at the same time, email, which you can, of course, now also do from your phone, no charge.
Yeah, no charge. And you can put, you know, big, you know, videos and pictures in email, but you can in the text message.
Fascinating. You know, David Pogue, who's a technology writer for the New York Times, did a thing a few months ago about how these phone companies, whenever you call to leave a voicemail for somebody, not only do you get the, hi, I'm not here, leave me a message, but then you get that automated thing that says, if you'd like to leave a message, stay on, push one or stay on the line. If you'd like to, you know, page somebody, as if anybody's still paging in the 21st century.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long thing. And he said, even if that takes 15 seconds, that's time being used up by your cellular phone account that's costing you money in the long run and making millions for these phone companies.
Exactly. I love that article, by the way.
I want to go back to food for just a second here, and restaurants in particular, and to the menus, because I don't see the 99 on menus, again, outside of fast food places. You look in that right column after you see what the items are in most sit-down restaurants, and they don't have the 9 at the end of the price. This is $8, this is $11, this is $34 for a steak, whatever it is. Well, where's the psychology there?
Yeah, they've found, again, that if they can minimize the price by not having a dollar sign, not having a decimal point, not having any cents figures, just have, like, 17 for the price, you will pay slightly less attention to it, and you'll be slightly more inclined to choose what you want as opposed to what's cheapest. Even the typography can really make a big difference. These price consultants recommend that restaurants don't have all the prices, you know, in a straight line, because then you can just go down the line and pick what's cheapest. Instead, they should have a little block of text describing each entree, and that way the price will be at different places that won't all line up. So it just makes it a little harder to compare prices, and in that way you'll be less price sensitive. Again, it's a small effect, but it definitely adds up.
Speaking of effects, what effect has the information age had on all of this? We live in a time where I can go online and find out and compare prices. You talked about real estate values before. There's a website called Zillow where you can actually go online and see how much your house would be worth and how much your neighbor's houses would be worth. How has that helped the consumer?
Well, about 10 years ago, they were really making this pitch that, you know, with the Internet, no one will ever have to pay full price for anything again.
Right.
But what's happened is that these price consultants have devised tricks that that make it harder to use the Internet for comparison shopping. One thing is that they have so many particular models, let's say, of flat-screen TVs, that even if you're one store and you find this model with about a 15-digit, you know, serial number on it, you may find that it's very hard to find any other store in the area that has that exact same model. And since it's not quite the same model, you don't know whether you can really compare the price to another one. Again, in almost anything you buy, there's a certain amount of wiggle room, and the price consultants really make the most of that.
This is all about behavioral psychology, and it's a fascinating topic, and you've done a great job writing about it. The book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. This is the sort of stuff that we as consumers, we don't think about it, and we are getting suckered in by this all the time, every single day. Pretty much every single item you buy, somebody sat down and thought, how can I get the most out of the guy for this? And congratulations on the work. Nice going. Thank you very much for your time today as well.
Thank you.
William Poundstone. Again, the book, Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Francine Show on 84 WHAS.